Hi, I'm Sean Duggan, and this is The Fix, a podcast about Photoshop, Lightroom, post-processing, and all the cool and creative things we get to do with our images after the shoot. Joining me this week is photographer Dan Burkholder, and we're going to be talking about a range of topics, including his pioneering work in creating digital negatives for contact printing, all the way up to using iOS devices for image processing platforms, not only from your iPhone, but also wirelessly transferred from other cameras. It's always a fun and interesting conversation when Dan Burkholder stops by, so stay with us. Well, thanks for tuning in and joining me here on The Fix, as always. Looking forward to talking to my guest, Dan Burkholder, today. Dan, thanks very much for stopping by.
Well, thanks for the invite. It's going to be fun.
And you are joining us from the mythical town of Palinville, New York.
Well, the town isn't mythical, but the town's really here. But it's legendary. The legendary home of Rip Van Winkle, and that's something in which we take a lot of pride. And of course, as a fan of afternoon naps, it's the perfect place to be located.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, when we were little kids and our parents want us to take a nap, we never wanted to take a nap, you know, because that's what like babies did, you know. But you reach a certain age, it's like, oh, a good nap is a great thing.
It is.
Well,
naps,
I think,
and 5-hour energy.
Yes, indeed. So, you have a studio out there, and you do workshops in Palinville. Is that correct?
Yes. For instance, one of the things that I only do here at our own studio in Palinville is that's a platinum workshop, and we only do one or two of those a year. But what I found is that teaching wet-based processes in other places, there are a lot of variables, and sometimes the chemistry is not fresh. Their equipment has kind of gone into decline. So, and you know, I just got my Medicare, you know, a couple months ago. So I don't really want to mess. The hassle factor has to be pretty low. So, so those we do just out of our own studio, where we had have a controlled set of variables, and we can, I think, give a richer experience for students. You know, they can learn more in a shorter time, where we're not troubleshooting broken hardware and bad chemistry.
Right. Yeah, definitely two headaches. Well, and that actually is a nice segue into how you got, or one of the ways you got your start working with digital processes, which was adapting digital techniques so you could use them in the analog world of platinum prints. And you know, this book here, which is a classic here, Making Digital Negatives for Contact Printing, I purchased that from you in 2000. That's when we first met, because I actually called you up and ordered it directly over the phone. When did you get involved? What did you say?
They're going for thousands of dollars on eBay now, those books. I'm kidding.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to sell mine, because mine's autographed. So, You had, of course, in making platinum prints, that's a contact printing process. And for those people who are not aware of that term, it means having a negative the exact size that you want your print to be and contact printing that onto the photo paper and, you know, processing it in a normal analog way in a wet darkroom. So when did you get the idea to try to figure out, how can I take my image that I've done in Photoshop and turn it into a negative?
Well, actually, at that time, I was living in San Antonio, Texas, and Hank Otter, who ran the best classic darkroom there, or the professional lab there in San Antonio, invited me to visit this business he had bought into, which was called a service bureau. And he, and I'll give a tip of the hat to Terry Weekly, another friend down there, he was another co-owner. They said, come on down and visit. And they had these machines called image setters running. And, you know, in the photographic world, you know, I'd never heard of an image setter, but that's something that was used in the offset press world to produce large negatives, whether it was like a grocery store ad. They'd use these negatives on flexible film to actually burn with ultraviolet the printing plates. Now, the printing industry has since moved on to direct to plate, so we don't see it. Those image setters are harder to find. But at that time, when I walked into that business and saw this large machine with these negatives creeping out and dropping into a basket, the light bulb came on. I said, there's got to be some way to appropriate this technology for those of us that need an enlarged negative to make platinum prints, cyanotypes, you know, Van Dyke prints or other kinds of, not Dick Van Dyke prints. But and they were very supportive.
And Mary Tyler Moore prints, too.
Exactly. So Hank and Terry were very supportive and, you know, let me run tests and stuff. And so, of course, in the first edition, which is before yours, the first edition was much smaller. It had dealt just with using these image setters to make enlarged negatives. And, you know, prior to that, if we were contact printers, as you mentioned, we were either shooting with a big camera to get a large negative to contact print, or we were going through a couple generations, right, making through optical projection, making maybe an enlarged interpositive, and then contact printing that to get a negative that we could then take into the classic darkroom to contact print. So fraught with uncertainties, both chemical and dust, et cetera. So to be able to make a digital negative was really quite a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you do that on inkjet printers using transparency material on inkjet printers. Yeah.
Yes, and sitting right just outside of camera here is an Epson P800. You know, one of the things I'm kind of forced into buying the newer Epsons because as users of my process, they start emailing and say, hey, I just got this new printer. Will it work? So I have to get one and run tests. And the P800 is making beautiful negatives, just as did the Epson 3880, their previous generation of tabloid size printer. So, and of course, you can also use, we have also out of camera here, a larger Epson, a 44-inch wide Epson. And I've trained artists around the world to make, they're making 40-by-60-inch platinum prints, making their negatives on large format Epsons. And that's not to say that Canon printers wouldn't work, but I've just kind of focused more on the Epson printers.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. And then in addition to, you know, I mean, you were really, I think the pioneer of that process, at least to my knowledge, making early on, you know, making digital negs for contact printing. But then you also developed, you definitely were the innovator of two printing processes that started out in your head and then in your workshop. And that was pigment over platinum and platinum over gold leaf. Is that correct?
Yeah, in the one case you have a good memory. Yes, the pigment over platinum was a way to combine the classic world. We're not ready to depart the classic world of wet chemistry, but to incorporate color, you know, we have one thing that digital has done for us that's just marvelous is it's addressed two problems with color photography. And, you know, you and I have both been in photography long enough to know that it used to be you had fugitive materials. You know, a Cibachrome might be 75 years before noticeable saving, but all the C prints and most of the other color processes, the colors would start to change rather quickly. So we had lack of archival materials, and we also had a lack of control. For anyone who's worked in the color printing darkroom with, you know, with a Chromega color head working in total darkness, you know how limited your options were to burn and dodge and to shift color selectively. So digital, as you know, has wonderfully addressed both those concerns. We got these incredible printers. They've got 200-year, you know, display life before any noticeable changing, and we have this amazing control with Photoshop, Lightroom, et cetera. So it's energized and made color exciting for photographers that previously would have been only interested in the monochromatic image because that's where they had good lasting materials and control. So, yeah, so the pigment over platinum, I'd actually take a watercolor paper, run it through the Epson printer to put a light wash of color down from these readily solid pigments, but then hand coat the platinum sensitizer, which has the consistency of about, you know, strong coffee, over top of that, dry it, make a digital negative, and contact print. So all the blacks and all the detail and contrast came from that platinum component, but yet the color came from that underlying inkjet print on the watercolor paper.
And then how did you get the idea to- I was going to say, how did you get the idea to do the platinum over gold leaf?
Well, thanks for asking. About 8 years ago, I thought, well, how can I make the platinum process even harder and more expensive? So I thought, well, kind of a stupid question as a point of departure, but that's kind of, so I thought, well, yeah, I wanted to do something special. So I thought, well, what about gold? So I started running some tests, and you know, many years ago, I'd been inspired by a Curtis. It was a print. It was he actually had, at least this was the description, it was gold dust suspended in banana oil behind a glass plate, and it gave a lovely look. Now,
was this Edward Curtis?
Edward Curtis, right.
Edward Curtis, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not a question of being anti-banana oil, but that seemed to have a level of messiness and vagaries that I wasn't ready to embark upon.
So you're gonna have banana peels around your lab, and that's like a recipe for slapstick.
Yes. So, you know, I printed on vellum many, you know, like 30 years ago with platinum. So I thought, well, let's revisit the vellum, and I would varnish it to make it very translucent. I said, well, that might be a good medium on which to apply the gold leaf. And sure enough, it works great. So on this vellum, it's a special vellum. It's tough, but not that tough. You know, it becomes very fragile when it's wet. But you make your classic platinum print, process that in the hot developer, the acid clearing baths. You wash it, you dry it, you flatten it. And then you have to make the gold leaf stick on the back. So, you know, in the paper world, we're used to the word size as it refers to affecting the absorbency characteristics of paper. You know, like, for instance, a very unsized paper would be like a paper towel. You put a blot of ink on it, and it just blops out. So then a highly sized paper would be like wax paper. You put a drop of ink on wax paper, it'll just sit there and really basically never absorb. So usually we want papers that are somewhere between those extremes that hold on to our material, but yeah, don't let it absorb in too deeply. Well, in the gilding world, they reuse the term size to refer to the that holds the gold. And so, you know, when people make those classic on wooden frames, the gilding or say a religious dome, they're using a size to hold that gold leaf. Well, in our case, or at least the way I wanted to apply it, since the gold leaf was going on the back, the adhesive was going to be between the vellum and the gold. So the adhesive had to be clear, had to be archival, and it had to give kind of a window of stickiness, a certain working time that would give you enough time to get that gold leaf on. And then varnishing the vellum makes it very translucent. So when you look at these, the light is going through the vellum, going through the platinum, hitting the gold and coming back out. Mm-hmm. And under, you know, it's just sort of like when you photograph objects that are metal objects. Really, it's all about reflections, right? You're really photographing reflections. Well, right. This is very light source intensive. Now, when these are displayed under a nice track light with like a 45 degree light, they're incredible. And they almost look, you know, quasi holographic. They take on a dimension. Under fluorescent lighting, flat lighting, like you wouldn't want to put on a platinum over gold leaf display in Walmart, for instance. They look kind of dead under those conditions. But under gallery conditions, they're wonderful.
But I hear that Walmart's
a special on gold leaf prints this weekend. Yes,
there we go. Yeah. At Walmart. I have seen some of your, you know, platinum over gold leaf displayed properly, and you know, yeah, you're right. It does have this incredible glowing luminescent quality that really makes it look almost like a precious, you know, icon or something like that. They're just stunning images.
Well, thanks for the feedback. But it's also subject matter dependent. For instance, one of the things I found out that high key images don't work particularly well for the gold leaf. Mm-hmm. Water, if you have lots of water, I tried some snow images, and yellow snow, it's kind of a Charlie Brown effect. Yellow snow just doesn't look good. And water, large bodies of water, they look kind of like pee when they're yellow. So low key images where the gold selectively shines through with the highlights glistening, they can be the most stunning images. And when in workshops, that's what I encourage students to do, to work with low key images. And we actually, you might be interested in this, Sean, we actually over sharpen a bit to give that kind of the acuteness, the edge effects, a little bit more bite. So the gold seems to glitter a little bit more.
Oh, interesting.
So we go for low-key images, a little bit more contrast than normal, and a little bit more sharpening than normal. And that really seems to accentuate the gold feel.
Oh, great. And then do you teach workshops in that process there at your place in the Catskill?
Now, the gold leaf on platinum only here, yes, at my own studio, but actually got coming up next month in Santa Fe, a workshop, and I'd like to plug it, but it's full right now. Now, I do have some workshops later in the year in May, iPhone workshops at Santa Fe, where there is still some room, but this next one's full. But it's called Platinum Printing in an Alternate Universe. And realizing that some people would like to learn how to work with these precious metals, but they're not going to have access to a wet, dark room. Well, let's face it. As Jill says, you know, the one thing digital did, it liberated tens of thousands of bathrooms to return to their original intended use. That had been, you know, bathrooms that had been converted into dark rooms. So a lot of people are not going to be able to print platinum. So what we're doing is we're printing on a different vellum that has an inkjet receptive coating. It's still archival. So we're able to make on a fine Epson printer a black and white print in this case, and then put the gold leaf on the back. So the people have the look of the platinum over gold leaf, or at least as close as we can get.
Right.
It's not precious metals, but we put the gold and the palladium, and that's something else that's exciting. A few years ago, I started grinding together the gold leaf with a pure palladium leaf, and that way you get like a cooler tone. Palladium has kind of a pewterish kind of color, so
yeah.
We get back to that, the yellow snow kind of anomaly. But by blending palladium and gold leaf, and also locally applying painter's gesso, which is pure white, we can add yet another dimension, another control on the print. So that's something we'll be doing in this alternate universe, inkjet printing in an alternate universe class in Santa Fe in just a few weeks.
Wow, that's a great description for the course and what you're covering. But I also love the title. The title that really speaks to me on a science fiction level.
It's funny how it did tickle the fancy of people. I mean, it filled up really fast. So
yeah, no. I think that there's a lot of photographers, particularly photographers, you know, both photographers who have a background in, you know, traditional analog darkroom practices, and maybe even, you know, newer photographers who've never had that experience. But I think that there is a definite interest in those processes that where you get your hands involved a little bit more in making of the image.
Boy, you are so right. And one of my drop lines over the years has been, it's a human drive. We like to make things with our hands. And whether it's going to take the form of sewing, auto repair, carpentry, gardening, you're going to find something to do with your hands. So if you love photography, why not find a way to exercise that drive within the photographic process itself?
Yeah. And I think that is also maybe one of the things that's driving the look of, you know, kind of antiqued or textured effects you can add to your images, you know, in camera phone apps, things like that. There's that maybe desire for that visual hint of the analog process.
Very well put, Sean.
Yeah.
You're right on.
And apropos that, that's actually an excellent segue into the next segment here to talk about. And that is your work with iPhones, iPhonography, and processing images on the phone. You're very well known for that. You've got a book out on that, and you teach regular workshops on that subject. And you got involved with the iPhone pretty early on as an image-making device. Like, you had the first one, right?
Well, no, I actually skipped the first one. You know, the first iPhone that Steve Jobs introduced in 2007, we affectionately referred to it as the silverback because it was the one that had the metal, the curved metal, like aluminum alloy back. So that didn't feel like a finished product. It had a little bit, you know, this was such a new thing. It definitely had that first generation kind of feel. So I skipped that one, but jumped in with the 3G, which actually had GPS built in, et cetera.
Right.
It felt like there was a level of useful maturity, and especially photographically as related, coming to the platform. And of course, when the App Store opened up, that changed everything.
Yeah.
And we all know where that went from there. So, but now we're up to, of course, the 6S and 6S Plus, which have the Force Touch. And now we have the iPad Pro, where we can use the Apple Pencil with pressure sensitivity. It's amazing.
And you're also using the Wi-Fi connectivity in your mirrorless camera to transfer images from that camera to an iOS device and then working on it right there on the iOS device.
Yes. And in fact, just a few months ago, we did our first trip to Cuba, Jill and I, and we're taking a workshop down there in April. That class is full. But if people are interested, we are planning another November workshop to take a group down. A marvelous country, marvelous people. But during that trip, I shot with mirrorless. I'm a really big Micro Four Thirds fan. 4 years ago, I sold all of my large DSLR gear and moved to Olympus and have just been thrilled with the experience. And the lenses are first class. Everything is, I can carry more lenses. That's what I like. I can carry more gear with less weight and be ready for more photographic opportunities. But the built-in Wi-Fi is really fun. And on this trip, I didn't even take a laptop with Photoshop or Lightroom. Now, we love Photoshop and Lightroom. We love the Creative Cloud. I mean, it's a deal. 30 some cents a day for the two most powerful image editing and image management programs imaginable for less than like half a candy bar, right? It's an incredible deal. But when traveling, I'd rather be putting my energy into shooting and enjoying the travel experience rather than heavy lifting with software, even software as good as Lightroom and Photoshop. Yeah. So I didn't even take a laptop, just took my iPhone and the iPad, and Wi-Fi shooting with the Olympus, Wi-Fi the images directly over to iOS, either the phone or the iPad, and editing there. And there's something magical about being able to wake up at 3 a.m. without disturbing your partner, pop out your iPhone, and edit your images. Let's face it, laptops are really desktops. And none of us use them on our laps, unless you're a journalist at a convention or something. You're not using it on your lap. You're using it on a desk. So it's a very different thing to be able to wake up and remain in bed and start working on your images. There's something quite mystical and magical and wonderful about that.
So when you're traveling like that, that actually brings up a question. So you haven't brought a laptop. Are you just, what mechanism are you using to back up your images while you're on the road? Are you just keeping them on the memory cards?
Just keeping them on the memory cards. When we shot film, we never had a way to back up our film, did we? And, there was always a slight risk factor. Everyone has to honor their level of paranoia. Some people think that the NSA is stealing every word they speak. Some people think that something is going to rob every pixel off their SD or compact flash cards. Honor that paranoia, but I'd rather focus on the very likely positive outcome rather than the remotely possible negative.
Right. Outcome. Well, apropos a remotely possible negative outcome, since you did mention the NSA here, that now they're going to key in to this podcast. They're going to be listening. They're going to be listening to us now.
Yes. Yeah, that made the flag go up, didn't it?
Yeah. But anyway, as of this morning, they still can't get into our iPhone. So we'll hope that stays the course there.
Yeah. How do you feel about Tim Cook's stating that Apple's not going to, he's going to fight the court order to open up their OS?
I kind of am in support of that. I mean, I think it could lead to a Pandora's box of just sort of, creating a backdoor into anybody's, iPhone or Android device phone. And, I heard a news story this morning where, basically somebody in the privacy rights field, an advocate for privacy rights, said, the government doesn't have the right or the authority to listen to every single conversation or to be privy to every little bit of information. And obviously there's a balance to be struck in terms of, national security interests and things like that. But if they could manage to do it just for that one phone, that would be, I guess, okay. But, obviously Apple's concerned that that's going to, create a slippery slope and to where, it's going to be all our phones.
We'll see how this shakes down, but I'm on Tim Cook's side like you at this point.
Yeah, me too. So anyway, well, that was a segue off the rails there. We quickly went off into national security territory. We cover it all here on The Fix, everybody.
Yes, we do.
This is a podcast of note. All right. So let's get back to the whole idea of doing the mobile workflow. When you transfer your images from your Olympus camera to your iOS device to work on them, do you find that the edits you apply are end up being the final edits, or are they more kind of a rough draft or proof of concept for something you might do in another program once you get back to your desktop computer?
Well, that's a very good and very thoughtful question. And, I'll speak personally, but I think the ratio of how much, you do iOS wise versus how much you might do when you get back to your final, like you said, workstation at home where you can do that heavy lifting. That ratio is going to vary from person to person. I like to think about probably 95% of the work is actually accomplished on the iPhone or iPad. But when you get home and you're on a big, glorious, you know, large 27-inch monitor or whatever, you're going to find some things. You're going to make some tonal adjustments. You're going to be working in a larger color space. You know, you're going to be in Adobe RGB or something bigger rather than just sRGB. That's pretty much the space of our iOS devices. So, yeah. Sure, you might make some final little tweaks. You'll do your final sharpening for print size. Whatever that is, whether it's a small print or a large print. But yes, most of it comes in the iOS device. And one of the things that I was enjoying with nighttime shooting, and I can show you an example, actually a couple different examples, shooting bracketing. And one of the things I love about mirrorless is to be able to set it in black and white mode. So whether you're using the LCD, the flip-up LCD, or you're using the electronic viewfinder, to see the subject in black and white. I mean, it's like taking you that much closer to your final output. You're no longer distracted by the color. If your end product's going to be a monochromatic image, why have to deal with color while you're composing and shooting? Mm-hmm. Now, many would argue, you know, many will say, well, I see in black and white. Well, sure, there's the disciplined eye. Many, you know, practiced seasoned photographers have developed that. But we're not looking for the hardest way to do anything, are we? Every step in photography, if you look at this, what are we up to, like 190 some years? I think, yeah, Niepce's photo was 1826, the oldest surviving photograph, 1826. So we're up to 190 years of photography. And every step in there has been to make photography more accessible and easier, hasn't it?
Right, yeah.
There hasn't been major development to make it more exclusive and harder. So, you know, taking that to heart, to be able to see the subject in tones of black and white. And I'm setting my camera, my Olympus, to do an auto bracket. And I'll give a plug. One of my favorite lenses, actually, especially for low light shooting, is this Voigtlander. That's an f.95 Voigtlander, a 17.5 millimeters. That's like a 35, right, with a 2x crop factor on micro four thirds. So it's right. A 35 f.95. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful lens, manual focus, or no metadata, there are no electrical contacts. It's strictly glass and metal you're putting on your camera. Now, it is stabilized with this. Yeah, that's a big plus. And, you know, I personally would never buy another camera that didn't have in-body stabilization, because that's just such a big plus. And I'd never buy a camera that didn't have a touchscreen. I mean, you wouldn't buy a smartphone that didn't have a touchscreen, would you? Where you use some joystick over here to the side, you know, dip, you know, it's crazy. It's completely crazy. So anyway, having said that, an alienated...
Cameras with joysticks could catch on. That could be the next new thing.
Well, as an aside, a friend that was in my class down in New York City just the other day, he had one of the new Pen F Olympuses. You know, that's a beautiful one that kind of pays homage to the Pen F from back in the 60s. And yeah. When you're using the electronic viewfinder to move the focus point with this, instead of using a little four-way controller to do that, XY axis to move your focus, you actually, with your finger, or in this case, thumb on the LCD. Now, you're using the electronic viewfinder, but you put your thumb on the LCD and fluidly move, just rub it around and move your focus point around on the screen. That is a thing of beauty.
That sounds slick.
That's the way every camera should be. And I'm sure the EM1 Mark II will have that when it's announced, probably at Photokina later this year. So that's much nicer than doing the dit.
Right. Yeah. So go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to start as I said, set it for auto bracketing for these low light shots. And if you want to go there, so I'd set it for normal under 2, over 2. And now with the app, the Wi-Fi app, right now, I think it's pretty much the same with most of the manufacturers. They're only sending the JPEG over via their app. If you want to get the RAW file, and you can process RAW files on iOS, but you're going to have to use, you know, like the Apple's card reader, the SD card reader, and you can process RAW with several different apps. But the JPEGs, I mean, a good JPEG is a thing of beauty. I mean, if you take 3 8-bit JPEGs and put them together, so I can actually can demonstrate how putting together these three bracketed JPEGs shot monochromatically, how we can get a beautiful, sweet tonality out of the image.
So you have a demo set up that you can share with us that goes over some of your workflow, how you might do with some mobile processing. Is that correct?
That is a truism.
A truism. It's a truthiness. Okay. Well, why don't you fire up your screen share and let's take a look at what you got to share.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's look at the three bracketed images. And in the camera roll, I'm going to go up here. And I used these just the other day. And here they are. And let's leave and go sideways. Does that work for you?
Yeah, that's showing up fine.
Are you seeing the... And this is a couple, actually, that's Anna and Alejandro. And they became friends in Cuba. And this is a picture of them on the seawall there at Havana with the full moon rising out of a cloud. Now, this is the like the average exposure. This is pretty much what the light meter, you know, recommended. So that's the normal exposure. There's one that's two stops under for better highlight detail in the clouds around the moon, et cetera. And yeah. Then here's the bracket exposure that came over two stops brighter. So it's normal under two, over two. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to meld those together, and you'll notice that here I have, and you'll see it up here, there is a hole, where is it? It's down here at the bottom. There's a folder of HDR apps, and we're going to open this guy up. And you see this guy right here? Pro HDR X.
All right, launch.
Now, not to be confused with Pro HDR, which is up here, and this guy right here. Pro HDRX actually uses three exposures. So let's launch Pro HDRX, and then we're going to basically load in those three images here. Now you'll see my drink there, my Diet Pepsi. So we're going to tap, and this menu down here it's called the hamburger menu. So then we're going to load this guy. We're going to go into the camera roll, and let's get those three images. And we get this nice message that says, please select up to three. So you don't have to do three. You could do two bracket exposures. But let's go to the camera roll and find those Alejandro. And they should be, I think I skipped over them. Where are they? They're right here somewhere because I just used them the other. Where the dickens did they go? We just had them
I
up in front.
I just saw them.
You saw them? Why am I skipping past them? Where'd they go? Where the dickens are they?
You know what I do for situations like this? Here's a little power tip for iPhone or other camera phone users. I have an album.
Yes.
Called In Process or something that I've created, and when I know I want to bring images into a certain app, but I don't want to go scrolling through my whole camera roll, I'll transfer those to the In Process album, and then I've got a much smaller grid of images to go through.
That's what you call smart. That's a smart thing to do. And let's select these. And so I selected the normal, underexposed, ever. Let's load those into Pro HDRX. I'm going to go side. Now, see how out of alignment they are? Because this was shot handheld, but did you see how they snapped? So
it's going through an auto alignment process when you bring them in.
Yes, that's one of the things it does. Now, you'll notice our sliders over here. We have these wonderful sliders. So the one labeled HDR, that's like, how do you meld the three? And as we move this back and forth, you'll see the tonality of the image change. So we're going to go up pretty high on there. And then, of course, this guy is our exposure compensation. So we can go up and basically brightness. And then this one is contrast. So we can really dial this in to get just the kind of results we want. And when we have that just the way we want, in fact, we'll take our contrast right about like that. So let's go ahead and hit this little button up here. And boy, don't they need to update the save icon? They're using a floppy disk, which young people have never seen.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. There are people today who have no idea what a floppy disk is.
That's exactly right. So now I just saved those. Let's go take a look at that. That'll be down in our camera roll, of course, at the end. We'll go back here and go into our camera roll and get out of those guys. And there's our combined shot right there at the end, and we'll go sideways on this guy. And I like to describe the tonality. It's sort of like a Hasselblad on Plus X. If you remember that beautiful kind of smooth look, a beautiful range of tones. I mean, we can zoom in here and look at this. Isn't that sweet? So it's wonderful. And I forget the ISO, but it's either, you know, probably around 1600. So you're actually getting some grain reduction because you're combining those three exposures also. So that's kind of a fun way to go. Now, can I give you another example where we actually take that image through some other apps?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, in fact, you mentioned about a good way to kind of do things. Now, do you use this app called Photo Manager Pro?
No, I don't. But, you know, every time I talk with you, I always pick up great new app ideas.
Well, the wonderful thing about Photo Manager Pro, it lets you have enduring, non-volatile albums of your work. And let me launch this. Now, I've built up quite a few over the years, obviously. For instance, there's an album called Friends. Now, I have no friends, so there's very little in there. But like, for instance, here's an album called Furry Friends. And if we go into Furry Friends, of course, there we have pictures of wonderful pictures of pets and stuff in there, and even a video of a 350-pound black bear that was in our front yard several years ago eating acorns that Jill had. So nice thing about Photo Manager Pro, these are not linked to your camera roll. If you make one of those extra albums in Photos, it's volatile. If you clear the images out of your camera roll, they're also cleared out of those extra. You mentioned like making it like a demo folder or something. Right. So I don't like those because they're volatile. The albums that you make in here in Photo Manager Pro are persistent. They're no longer linked. So you suck in the images from your camera roll, but then they're discrete. And see, in this little demo album, I have those three that we did and I could have gone here, but I have this landscape that I just shot week before last when I was teaching over in Vermont and it snowed. So the same thing, normal under two, over two. So I'm going to send these are in Photo Manager Pro, but I'm going to hit select and then select those three images. And then see the little export button down here at the bottom? I'm going to send those back to our camera roll because we can't edit directly in Photo Manager Pro. Now, we did not clear those out. And if I cleared these originals out of the camera roll, it would not affect these images in Photo Manager Pro. Like I said, they're no longer linked. They're not like aliases. Those extra albums we make in Photos are sort of just linked to the original. And you clear out your camera roll, and then you got these Walking Dead albums with nothing in them. So now, just as to wit, we'll take a look at those. And there they are. There's three images. So we're going to put these together, but then we're going to take this a little bit farther. So let's jump back to Pro HDRX and launch Pro HDRX. And then we'll tap that little button there. And we're going to select those three images, those landscapes. And there's the under normal, overexposed. We'll hit done. So we're going to do kind of the same thing, except this time with the landscape. And there you see the lack of alignment. And in about 3 seconds, one, two, bam, it aligns them. And nice. We already have those sliders again. So we can take, look at this, we can play with that. So we're with this HDR slider, basically you're biasing, how it blends those three exposures, right? So we're going to go up pretty high and we'll lighten that guy up a little bit. And with contrast, we might go down a little bit. So let's go ahead and save this by hitting the save icon. Now, whenever we save an image, Sean, where does it go?
Well, it depends, I guess. Back to the camera roll. Some apps will also save it into their own little specific, light box or whatever on the app.
Yeah, but let's talk our camera roll. It'll be the last image in our camera roll, right?
Yeah.
So let's go back here. Now, we're going to go into, and I'm sure this is one of your favorite apps, too, up here. This guy, Snapseed, right?
Oh, yeah. We use it every day.
And yes, I mean, it's just, I tell students Snapseed should cost at least $50. It's just so marvelous in what it can do. And now, are you using a 6S or 6S Plus?
I'm just using the 6.
Okay, well, 6. That doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person, Sean. Don't get me wrong.
I'm relieved to hear that.
But for those listeners and watchers that are using like the latest generation, the S and either the smaller S or the larger S Plus, we have that new feature called Force Touch, and we're actually going to show and I can save myself several steps. So I'm going to push kind of with a little more firmness on the Snapseed icon. So rather than launch it and then dig into the camera roll, I'm just going to push harder here. And look at this, I can open the latest image. So that's a nice time saver, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's a good, nice. That's a really, and also sometimes you're going to work on an image that you've dug through your camera roll and it's way up there. It's hundreds of images up and you find it and say, oh, that's, and you try to remember where it is in your camera. Okay. And you'll say, okay, it's three images to the right of that bad picture of my foot. But instead, when you want to work on one of those, you can copy it in the camera roll. You can copy it and then paste it in here. So that's yet another time saver. So, but we're going to do this open latest image. And it will open, there it is, bam. Now, the first place we're going to go, you know, our interface, this is this little pencil down here is our, that's our doorway to control, isn't it? And we're going to go to HDR Escape down here at the bottom. And so I'm going to tap on HDR Escape. And look at what that did right out of the box. See how it kind of evened out the tonality in there, even with their cam settings? Nice. And of course, on Snapseed, one of the things we love about Snapseed is their interface. And I'm just taking my thumb and running up and down on the screen. So their default filter strength of 50 actually didn't work too bad. But we can, after choosing that, we can go left and right to take that filter strength up and down. And we're getting some readout. So it's an amazing thing. And the Pro HDRX did put a little bit of brown warmth into the image, which I kind of like. But we could take that out. We could go back to a pure neutral. But I'm just going to take a little. We're going to leave a little bit of that warmth in there. But, and I'm hitting our little before and after button, our like a preview checkbox in Photoshop up here in the upper right. And so we look how we've smoothed out. We've augmented that nice, that tonality of the light coming through on the campus where I did this workshop. So let's apply that.
And so once again, kind of, these shots were taken with your Olympus camera, right?
Yes, they were shot with the Olympus handheld at night with that Voigtlander, that f.95 lens. And then wide the three, and I had it set in black and white. So actually, you know, visualized on the LCD, the images were shown in black and white and in the electronic viewfinder. So it was blam, 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 three shots, Wi-Fi the JPEGs over. And these are the JPEGs that came over from the Olympus that we just combined first in Pro HDRX. And then we tweaked them a little bit to take it from there. And I'm just pressing down on the image here right now to do before and after. I love that interface that you just press on the image itself to see what you've done to the image so far.
And that's actually a new advance in Snapseed for iOS, as I understand it.
Which thing are you referring to, Sean?
Where you press on the image to see the before and after.
I think that's been there for a little while.
Well, it used to be that there was a little icon up in the upper right corner.
Here's what you're thinking. When you're in one of the modules, either what they call, let's click down here on the pencil again. When you're in either what they call tools or filters, then you have that preview button in the upper right.
Yeah.
But when you've hit apply, when you're just looking at the image and you're ready to decide on another module, then you just press on the image to see before and after. I'm just pressing on the image itself. You no longer have a little before and after in the upper right. So you're right. Now let's we just did the HDR Escape, which I think did some nice stuff on here. The shadows aren't quite so gruesome and foreboding anymore. But let's see if we can even get a little nicer. And let's tap on that pencil down here again. And this time we're going to go into one of my favorites, which is tonal contrast. Is that one of your favorites too?
Yeah, that's a nice one. Yeah, definitely. Let's see what you can do with that.
And tonal contrast, they come up. I wish they came up with the controls for tonal contrast zeroed out, but they don't. It's not a perfect world. So they always come up at 30, 50, and 30. And this image is pretty forgiving. It's not that bad. Let's hit. Now, there's our little before and after icon, our preview button up here, Sean, in the upper right. But look, see what that's doing? There's before, after. And I love the fact that we can pinch in here and zoom in here and still do before and after. So their default settings are not too shabby, are they?
No, it's looking good.
For this image. Yeah, and it's also great when you do zoom in, you have down here in the lower left, just like the navigation panel in Photoshop, we can move that little, with the finger or stylus, move that little box around that's showing us the area of the image that we're working on. It's amazing interface. That's why we say this app could easily cost $50, and I know I'd personally pay $50 for it. So we could...
Keep your voice down. We don't want Google or the NSA to hear that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, Nick developed this app and sold it to Google. And a lot of us were afraid that it would go to hell when Google bought it. But let's give credit where credit's due. Google has made several improvements on this app. They've added some wonderful functionality and some terrific features to Snapseed. And it's still free. And thank you, Google, for doing that. I mean, it's just, I think all of our iPhone people, this should be our first go-to app as we work on this. So let's just go ahead and apply that, that little bit of tonal contrast. And I'm going to do one more before we finish up in here. We're going to hit a little pencil down there. And we're going to go into drama. And here we have drama down here. And drama that also comes up with kind of a strong default. Let's do our before and after. But there again, not too bad. I think it's a little overdone. So let's go up and down here. And the filter strength, their default is 90%. I think they had someone with a little bit too much testosterone in their system designing this interface. So let's take it down to maybe like about 40. And you can see there's before and after. But there again, we're trying to get that feeling of that backlight. In fact, there was a light source eclipsed by that middle tree, hence the shadow coming straight towards the camera. So all we're not trying to make this look kind of overdone with HDR and everything, but we are trying to get the feeling of that night light and the footprints in the snow and the backlight on the trees and the art building in the background. Just make that look as pretty as we possibly can. So just by tweaking that down, that's kind of nice. So let's just go ahead and apply that. Now, obviously, we could spend a whole lot of... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, Dan. So in terms of the types of effects that you're applying to images in, you know, iOS apps, is there a general, you know, workflow in terms of there are certain types of processes or effects that you would apply earlier in the process, and then are there other types of effects that you would tend to apply later in the process for specific reasons?
Oh, a well-seasoned question. It's probably helpful. I like to divide our mobile imaging workflow. We, you know, instead of calling it just iPhone, that helps include the Android people a little bit, into sort of like three segments. And the first one is like capture or shooting. You know, we use certain apps. In this case, I did shoot with a bigger camera, the Micro Four Thirds Olympus, and bring them over. But even if we're shooting on the iPhone itself, we have apps like Vivid HDR, which is a life changer. You're probably a fan of Vivid HDR, right?
Yeah, I have that, yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing how the image quality just takes a big jump up. So we talk about different shooting methods, you know, some apps that let us change our shutter speed manually or our ISO. And personally, I don't really get into those. I just find them a little too wonky. But so we talk about the best ways to shoot to capture our image. And then we move into the second area, which is editing. And by editing, we mean everything from, say, if you discover there's a cigarette pack in the corner of your landscape, you might use an app like Handy Photo to retouch that out. I think it's probably the best retouching app we have. But within that editing phase are also things that affect contrast, color balance, all those kind of standard editing changes. And then third, Sean, we move into stylizing. And of course, as you mentioned, we are in the age of grunge and textures and vignettes. You know, once in a while on the internet and on Facebook, people will say, I'm so sick of seeing these images slammed, you know, with Instagram. Now, I'm personally not an Instagram person, but slammed with these filters. Well, I'll tell you, personally, I'd much rather see some of these creative images that have been, quote, slammed with filters than some of the sterile, antiseptic images we had come out of the F64 movement, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century or mid part of the 20th century, when we had images which were everything was perfectly sharp and every tone was in its place. And they were some of the most boring, uninteresting images imaginable. I mean, fortunately, there were happy exceptions like there always are. Yeah. But, you know, the pendulum always swings, and we're in a computational part of photography where people are embracing those nostalgic looks, those textural looks. I mean, it's very exciting. And, you know, the pendulum will swing again. There'll be something else coming around the corner. But I say enjoy it while it's there. So we got the shooting phase, the editing phase, the stylizing phase. And then, of course, there's output, and we have wonderful apps like you've probably played with that Mosaic app that lets you you can within like 3 minutes time pull. You can design a hardcover book that will be delivered to your door in like 3 days for $20. It's 20 pages, $20. It's magical. So that fourth phase would be output, and it's just incredible what we can do.
So in terms of like I always felt that in my own workflow that for mobile, you know, iOS processing, things such as blurring, I would tend to apply before I applied a texture, because if you add a blur after you've applied the texture, you're going to be blurring and softening some of the texture, which is going to look weird and not natural. But if the blur is supposed, to be part of the photographic process, either through the lens or whatever, you blur it and then you add the texture on top of it, which is going to create a much more natural look.
No, you're 100% right. Now, fortunately, there are some apps that kind of take care of that for us. Distressed FX, not one of the apps that I would normally use on this image. Time permitting, I might take this into Photo Toaster, but Distressed FX, which gives us a wonderful range of textures and overlays and color shifts, they have a blur function where it will blur the image, but in selectively, either within like an ellipse or you can do like a tilt shift kind of blur, but it will not blur the texture that it's applying. So that kind of takes care of that automatically for you by blurring your image detail, but not your textural detail.
Yeah, that's a nice feature, definitely.
It is. Yeah, it's kind of thoughtful. Hey, shall we take this? Shall we save this?
Let's save it. We've got about, 10 more minutes or so. You can like bop it into another app and do a final thing if you want to.
And before we hit save, let's point out this number 3 up here, which is really incredible. We have, if we tap that, we have what many viewers will compare to the history panel in Photoshop or even in Lightroom. Every step that we've done is recorded here, and we could even selectively go in there and either mask and apply that effect locally or change the slider positions. And that's nonlinear. We could go back to that HDR escape step and change that without affecting the subsequent tonal contrast or drama. It's really pretty stunning. And remember, this did cost how much? Nothing.
Nothing, I know. It really is amazing.
Now, here, I do want to take like 30 seconds to explain. This is the one thing people don't understand here in Snapseed. When they hit save, they get save changes. This will actually change your image. So it will ask permission to do that, but I don't recommend this because, we like to have it. We like to have like a save as instead of a save. We don't want to change that original. The save a copy will actually give you an image you could open weeks or months later and actually have access to that history and make changes on everything you've done to the image. And this export just saves off like a flat. You could think of this as a flattened JPEG. I usually do that middle one, save a copy. So I'm just going to take this and it kind of plays back. I'm going to take that image into up here in the upper right. I'd say 90% of my images right now get kissed by Photo Toaster. And are you a Photo Toaster nut, Sean?
I don't have the current version. I've used it in the past, but I'd be interested to see what the current incarnation looks like.
This is another one. It's got a beautiful interface. It is a little bit different. But one of the things you're going to love about Photo Toaster, see this little world icon in the lower left?
Yeah.
Well, if we tap on there, and let me cycle through, they have a bunch of presets. I'm not going to do any of these, but they have, you look at all these, they got bright, sunny, chilly, serenity, sunset, prostate exam, black and white portrait, newsprint. They got a whole range in there. Just what you'd expect. If we tap where it says that corner, where it says basic again, there's another whole set of deluxe presets. And then there's even one called Supreme down there. Now, I always tell students, play with those on your own time. Where it gets exciting is when you hit that little chevron, that little down facing arrow, and you get to make the changes. But let's go in there once and say if we wanted to put a border on here, I'll tap that little border guy. And guess, look at all the borders we have. Just beautiful.
That's nice.
For like Facebook, that parchment is kind of nice, and we can change the thickness. We can put a texture on there. So say if we want to put like a stone type texture on there, and if we zoom in, you'll see that texture kind of coming in there. See that stone texture coming in. So
yeah.
We can do anything here. We can go back to the FX and we could actually fade it to make it look like an old faded photograph. Or we could make it completely cold or take the warmth up with saturation. The intensity, which is a little bit like a clarity slider in Lightroom. So after you find this wonderful combination, oh, by the way, this little button down here that looks like a Subaru hood ornament, that is vignetting. So we could put some vignetting on here if we wanted to make that lighter or darker. So we can do a reverse vignette or anything we want on there. But when you find this combination that you like, we can save a preset, and that's where we revisit this little world button down here on the lower left. And after Supreme is my presets, and you can hit new, add new, and give it a name. So we can call this like, I'll call it Vermont, Vermont Woods, V-O-M-O-N-T, Vermont. Well, in fact, we'll call it Vermont And I'm going to run this all together to save space. Vermont at night. Point. And it may truncate that title. That's why I'm running it together. Let's hit add. And then there it is. See, oh, it truncated the last couple. But on any other image, if I like that set of effects with the vignette, the border, the texture, the tonal control, the saturation, we could open another image and with one tap apply that. So any app that lets you save a preset is a beautiful thing. And their interface, there again, I'm just it was like in Snapseed where we just pushed on the image. I'm just pushing with my thumb on the image and it shows you a before and after of everything you've done. Isn't that sweet?
That is beautiful, yeah. Looks nice.
And then, of course, there's our share button in the upper right. We'll hit that, and we'll hit that, and we'll save that to the photo. Well, they call it photo library, but it's going back into photos, into our camera roll. And the world is right again. So thanks for letting me go through that little demo. It's a fun thing.
No, that was excellent. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Sure. I get excited all every right. time I do this stuff. It's just...
Well, you're definitely good at passing that excitement around and sharing it with other people too. Well, that was excellent. Gave me some ideas. I'm definitely going to revisit the photo toaster app. I do have an older version on my phone, but I haven't opened it in a while. You know, that's the way it is with apps. You kind of go through these phases where you sort of gravitate to a certain handful of apps, and then, you know, maybe another app comes along and then you stop using it.
Yes, so, and it's kind of embarrassing, but I was just going to say, right now I have, I know we're short on time, but I just want to show, I'm just going to check here. I actually have on my iPhone 750 apps. Isn't that sinful? That's an embarrassment.
And what percentage of those are photo apps? Probably most of them, right?
Well, maybe 35% or so. But no, your point is much more important, that we develop a certain suite of apps. And, you know, the object isn't to learn 300 different apps. It's to learn which ones kind of let you, your vision for an image, that let you walk that image from capture to what you want to say about the image. How do you make that photograph yours?
Right, yeah. And, you know, apropos apps, because there are so many of them, whether you're, you know, on an Android platform or iOS, one little bit of advice I will share with people is that one thing I always look at before I get an app for photo processing, I want to know if that app will support at least the native resolution that my phone camera produced, because some apps will only support a smaller resolution picture. And it's very disappointing. You do all this work and you realize, oh, wait a minute, this is even smaller than the original picture.
Well, you're exactly right. And as a heads up, I mentioned Distressed FX. Without giving the bad news, Distressed FX is an app that does not honor your full resolution. It will knock your res down.
Right.
Now, Distressed FX is great for these painterly kind of effects. So if you're willing to sacrifice resolution, you can get some very nice things, but it would not be for, you know, a pristine image of the Brooklyn Bridge where you want to make a 20x30-inch print. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, definitely. So a word to the wise, look for that when you go to the App Store or, you know, wherever you buy your Android apps. You know, try to find the details. And some apps do not even tell you in their description. They don't even mention that. Some apps will. But, you know, Dan actually introduced me to a great app when we were together at Photo Fusion in Florida several weeks back called ViewXIF, which is a great way to just look at a picture and see what the dimensions are. So you can process it in an app and see if that version that came out of the app honors the original size of the picture.
Exactly. And it shows up in your camera when you're in your camera roll and you tap your share button, ViewXIF, along with, you know, sending that via email or message, ViewXIF will be right there and let you check your pixel dimensions. So thanks for mentioning that app. It's a great one.
No, it's great. No, thanks for turning me on to it, because I found it very useful and I've since been recommending it to, I've been the ViewXIF Johnny Appleseed, you know.
99 cents well spent.
Yes, indeed. So, Dan, where can people find out more about you and the work and you're doing and your workshops and such?
Oh, the best way would be at my website, which is danburkholder.com. And there'll also be a link to the workshops that Jill, my wife, does in encaustic and Bromwell and such. And we got workshops coming up. I know, like you, we got one coming up in later in the year in Iceland. We got one up in Lake Superior at Madeline Island. We got one in September in in Tuscany, and I know I'm missing some other really good places. I'm actually going to be going back down to the Palm Beach Photographic Center next month for a couple iPhone classes. There's still room in those. So lots of places where they can tap into some fun and information on enjoying photography.
And apropos fun, you also have a new podcast that you're doing called Photo Trash Talk. So we do have a few minutes left. Give us the skinny on Photo Trash Talk. Well, first of all, how'd you come up with the name?
Give a tip of the hat to my partner in crime with Photo Trash Talk, Elmo Sapwater. And that is his real name. This is not a stage name, Elmo Sapwater. Known him for decades. We used to work together. He was an editor of a magazine way back, an electronic imaging magazine. So we've developed a really good, warm friendship. And he came up with this great idea that we would put our energies together and talk about trends, gizmos, and things in the world of photography. And we just put a new episode up, and you can find them at phototrashtalk.com, or you can email us with suggestions for topics to cover at howdy@phototrashtalk.com. But we try to never take ourselves too seriously. We're sort of like, you know, it's kind of like the click and clack of the photography world.
And those come out, once a month, twice a month?
We're trying to move up to weekly, actually. He's just put up two in the past week. Last week, it'll be coming up very soon. We actually went on the road, and we interviewed and filmed on site in a camera store. It's in the third generation, 102-year-old photo store business up in Schenectady, New York. And we'll have that one coming up. So that was really fun.
No, that does sound interesting. Cool. So because initially it was just an audio podcast. Are you going to go into doing a video podcast now?
Well, we think we're going to have to put some video in sooner or later. We're still, the nature of a podcast is audio, but for one, we did about a month ago, we recovered one of the drones, manufacturer sent us a drone to test. And of course, how do you talk about a drone? You got to do some fun footage. So we actually went out in the snowy field at a friend's house here, a B&B here in town. And we did. So there's some of that on Photo Trash Talk. Be sure to watch the video of where we lose our virginity in drone flight. And it was a happy ending. The drone did not crash.
Well, that's always good. Excellent. All right. Well, it's been great having you on. We should do it again sometime, because you're always good for sharing information about new gizmos and apps and stuff like that.
You've certainly, your questions have all been so right on target. And thanks for having me, Sean. It's been a blast.
Sure. Welcome. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in and joining us on The Fix. Remember, you can always subscribe to the audio version of The Fix on iTunes, or you can go to the website, thisweekinphoto.com/The Fix, to watch the video version. And there's also a link there to a downloadable audio version if you want to access the audio version there as well. We will be back next week with more on The Fix. I'm Sean Duggan. Thanks for watching.